This is KHBR, the voice of darkness for the intrepid travelers of the left-hand path. I'm Magister Robert Adams, your host. We'll be accompanying you on your journey. So get ready, sit back, relax, and prepare to kefir and remanifest. This is KHPR, the voice of darkness. I'm Magister Robert Adams, and today we're going to look at art and culture in Setian initiation. With me today, I have priest James Kirby, who is an artist within the temple, who has done some incredible work that we're going to talk about. Welcome, James.
Thank you, Magister Adams. Good to be here.
I have seen some of your artwork, and I have to say, we have had numerous artists within the temple, but usually they'll be a painter or a sculptor. You kind of do everything.
Yeah, that's a dynamic I developed in my youth where I get bored very quickly with things. So I tend to expand my knowledge base of different materials, and it's basically working with materials. So whether it's paint or glass or gemstones or whatever, it's simply another form of material, and each one presents a challenge. So I enjoy that challenge in my work.
Let's talk about one item in particular that I first saw at the conclave we had in San Francisco. And at that conclave, you presented to Dr. Aquino a hand-carved stela of Set that you made out of, I believe it was flagstone?
Pipestone.
This was a very solid piece, and it definitely was so well done. It looked like something that you could see in a museum. And I just sort of thought of you mostly as a sculptor. Now, how did you go about making this piece?
The piece itself was made in my mind probably a year after I entered the temple. I saw the stele in one of our documents, and that Dr. Aquino had drawn many years back. And I have a really strong passion for Egyptian art, and I thought, this needs to be made. And what happened was, I moved from southern Canada into the north, and I purchased a stone while I was down there, a piece of pipestone. And pipestone is a sacred stone to the First Nations people in the United States, and they use it for making their ceremonial pipes. And because it's red, I thought this would be the perfect stone for that stele. And it took me about 3 years to think it through, to make that. Because Egyptian carving is a lot different than contemporary carving. It's a bas-relief, very finely detailed lines in it, and a really slight bas-relief. It's not a deep bas-relief in their work. And if people don't know what bas-relief is, it's a surface carving, and it takes a great deal of skill to pull off something like that and make it look like it's supposed to, like the Egyptians were extremely adept at. And I thought, for my first Setian piece, that would be the one that I wanted to accomplish. And because of my work with fossils and preserving things for museums, I have a high degree of quality that I demand from my work. And it probably took about 2.5 months to carve that piece. But when doing magical work, I think every aspect of it, from where I get the rock to how I produce the idea to how I put that idea into the stone, is important. So that particular piece got a lot of attention, and well, actually all my pieces do, but that one was the beginning. So
now when you carve on the pipestone, is this You know, I've seen people do this before. Are you just using a standard hammer and chisel?
For some of it, yes, hammer and chisel and die grinders. And first, I started off with a 7-inch grinder, and I cut the stone to the shape of a stele, which is has the rounded top on it. Looks kind of like a tombstone, actually. And there is a science of steleology out there somewhere. I'll find it one day on what all that means. And then hand chisels, die grinders, Fordhams, dental tools, and it just progressively gets smaller to where you're using actual dental picks and really, really small knives to cut the lines in the stone. And you go over and over and over it until you get the depth you want. And then you polish it with diamond tools as well.
So that must take some very meticulous, time-consuming effort when you get down to that phase.
Mm-hmm. It's one of the hardest things to learn in art is to finish your work. And this was a thing I growing up in the Arctic, I find that there's a big push for artists to create tourist trinkets and stuff like that. So they get a hold of really beautiful materials and they hack out these tourist items for people, and they rarely finish their work because there's no call to finish them. I started a standard in my work right from the start where I was going to finish my work no matter how. I mean, it took me a long time to learn this craft, but no matter how long it takes to produce a very high quality piece of work, and that in itself it puts you in a different category as an artist right away. So if there are artists out there, I encourage them to really finish their work. Yeah, that's very important.
Well, and from this, I started talking to you and several other people did about what other things you worked with. And you had started working with metal, and you actually created the ring for the Order of the Trapezoid, which is a very outstanding ring. And I know a lot of people have gotten them, and for them, the fact that the ring is made by a member of the temple adds a little more magical power to it for them. It's sort of like all-in-house kind of thing, and it really has made people want the ring, and it's a very nice piece, I have to say.
Yeah, metal came along because stone carving has its drawbacks. You're breathing in a lot of dust, and your health eventually suffers from that. And I wanted to keep doing my art, and one of the things that I'd always hoped to do but never really thought I could do was create magical jewelry. I have the magic. I have no problem with that. But the skill level involved in metal work is much more refined than stone carving. And what I found was that as soon as I applied myself to it, I was... the goldsmith that teaches me actually said that you're light years beyond anyone who starts doing this kind of work. And so I had an aptitude for it. And I think all the carving skills where you finish the work, you know, you force yourself to finish what you do, really helped in that regard. And creating magical jewelry is one of my passions. It gives me the impetus to, or the space to use my magic in my artwork and create an initiatory environment in my studio, which has all kinds of levels to it. But the most important one is the end result, and that is when the person gets the piece from me and they can immediately feel that there's something different about this piece of jewelry, or, you know, yes, it's just a piece of metal and all that, but it is a lot more than that because of how it was created, the intention behind the creation. And I think the Egyptians knew a lot about that. And that's where a lot of my studies in the Order of Setnekamawast come into play. And I use that knowledge in my creations. So, yeah.
And it's my understanding that because of the creation of the OTR ring, it also has now led to a creation of a ring for the Order of Setnekamawast. Is that correct?
That is. And also the Order of the Vampire and, well, all kinds of other things. It's been a beautiful process. Again, putting that the integrity of magical, our magical tradition, the Setian tradition, into creating artwork for other Setians gives me the
the encouragement to do.
It really encourages the best in me, and so I spend a great deal of time designing these things, making sure that they're going to work for everyone involved, but yet I can keep a standard style with the actual image that I'm creating and make it fit for everybody. Yeah.
Now for you, how do you see art and your creating of these pieces of artwork relating to your personal initiation? And also, because you're a member of the priesthood, you also affect other people's initiation with it. So how does one affect the other for you?
Living art. I consider my life an art piece. It's one single piece that I'm making from the time that I self-initiated till the time that I'm no longer in this meat machine. And that is by way of creating an initiatory environment with almost everything I do. Now, a lot of people can't do that. They have day jobs. They have to take their mind away from initiation, put it in another place. I don't have to do that. I can keep my mind in my initiation almost all the time. And I need a break from that once in a while, so I take them, but there's appropriate times for that. But living art and creating it within my personal life, with my children, with my the various contacts that I have in the art world, and most of all, I want to create initiatory art. That is the goal of my job as an artist, and it works out very well with Setian initiation. I find that I've had to engage a lot more of my intellect with my temple work, and that was a balance that needed to happen for me. So my work in the various orders that I work with and the elements in the temple is all geared towards balancing the artistic side of life with the practical side of life, which is, you know, getting my stuff done when I need to get it done, and my personal stuff, and also creating really good art while I'm doing that.
I see. And, you know, one of the things that what you just said reminded me of is something that Dr. Stephen Flowers had once said is, you know, when you create something and you drop it, it makes a sound. It gives you the affirmation that it really does exist. Whereas now today in the world of the internet, you know, anyone can set up a website and suddenly they have this, you know, large online community of magicians, yet 10 years from now, it's all just electrons that may or may not represent what it originally did. Whereas, you know, your Stella of Set that you made, or the Order of the Trapezoid Ring, I mean, these are things that are going to be passed down through generations. And so it's going to make and bring about more change with them.
Mm-hmm. This is one of the beauties of studying with the OSK, is that you learn how things made in the past affect the future. And when you study the artwork of the world, and you start to get a handle on just how much is out there, and how it was created, why it was created, and where that those people saw that artwork going. I mean, the Egyptians created their artwork to be eternal. That's why it's made out of these big, massive chunks of granite and whatnot. And it's still here today. And I can go look at a stele with Set on it and be just as inspired as you know, the ones I create. But then I have to look at, okay, did I do this right? I'm pitting myself against artists who are 4,000 years old. Right. They're not around anymore. And this kind of creation gives an artist a sense of immortality in their own work. Like, yes, it's a rock. It can be broken, and, you know, it can be blown up, but it can't be burned. It can't, you know, the house can fall down, but the rock is probably still going to be okay. These things survive for some reason. And I think that has a lot to do with the intent and the energy that's put into them. And that, again, harks back to creating magical artwork. It is, you're creating something that's going into the future in order to change the future and to help change other people's perception on magic and just what that means.
Yeah, and I think something, you know, that to me I find kind of humorous is, you know, if say 10,000 years down the road, there's some archaeologists working in and around San Francisco here and happen to dig up the stele of Set in the remains of Dr. Aquino's house, and you know, yeah, they suddenly go, my God, the Egyptians. Yeah. They were in
San Francisco.
Yeah, you know, I mean, you know, things like that are really going to screw with the heads of a lot of archaeologists down the road many years, you know, if the planet's even going to be in existence in 10,000 years, the way people are talking nowadays.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's their problem. We'll create it how we want.
Yeah, exactly.
I used to bury things when I was a child, and like I'd find old pennies or something, or my hockey card collection or whatever, and I'd bury them in the ground. Well, I buried my father's Golden Gloves boxing belt one day.
Oh, wow.
Promptly forgot where I buried it. So I went back to this place I used to live a few years ago, and I asked at all the secondhand stores if anybody had ever dug one up, and they didn't yet. So it hasn't been found yet. But yeah, that idea has been with me a very long time too. That things go into the future, that things will come back to you, or they will go into the future and come back to people that they belong to. And yeah, I like that the artwork that I create will be around for a long time.
Now, have you ever thought of creating a piece of art that has Setian significance to it, or maybe even like embedded something Setian into a piece of art and then sold it to someone outside the temple just to see if you can cause change outside the organization?
Oh, absolutely. I do that all the time. I do that with almost every piece that I do. Almost all my pieces have a hidden aspect to them. It's either something carved inside the piece and then has another piece put over top of it, so it will never be seen.
Interesting.
And lots of people have asked me, well, why do you do that? Well, I don't know why I do that. I just do it because it makes me feel good.
Yeah. I can see it as kind of a sort of magical act of sorts. Even, you know, on a level of the lesser black magic sort of thing. You know, you're just sneaking something in and see if they catch it.
Yeah, exactly. And this past summer, I carved a Tale of Two Brothers, which is the story of Set and Horus.
Right.
And I was at a big arts festival up in the Arctic, and so I'm carving this piece, and obviously nobody up there knows what the hell this is, because it's, you know, the symbolism is not Arctic, it's not a whale, it's not a dancing polar bear or something like that. It's Set and Horus. And everybody's very curious about this, but nobody's really interested in it. And on the very last day, a fellow came up to me and he says, I've seen this. You watched you carve this piece and I have to have it. And I looked at him. I said, well, what is it about it that you like? And he said, it's dark and light at the same. And he's not a set in. He's from a big city and has all kinds of other interests in life. And so he told me about this darkness and light that he saw in it, and a balance, and there was a shaman in the middle of it. And so this piece actually is in a collection in a big city with a non-Setian, and it is completely Setian. And we'll have a picture of it on your website after this, but I love doing that. Yeah.
I mean, that's really interesting that he looked at it and he was able to understand the darkness and light of
Set and Horus. He recognized it. And I mean, that's really like, I don't do art on demand. I can't do that. It's almost impossible for me. It has to be something that I'm passionate about. And because initiation is such a big part of my life, well, a lot of my pieces are about initiation. And they will go to who they belong to. I have a real big thing about putting things in the right hands. And people have to connect with my work. I had one guy willing to give me $15,000 for a piece once, and he wanted to stuff it in a corner in his office, and it was a werewolf piece, and he had no idea what he was looking at. He just liked the price tag, and he had the money to buy it. And I says, well, I'm not selling it to you. You don't know what it is. You don't know why you want it, and go away. My gallery owner got very mad at me about that, but whatever. Yeah, they have to go where they belong. And mostly that's to people that don't have the money. So I give them away.
So you have, as an artist, you also have an ethical side of distributing your artwork. Is you want the people to understand it and be able to fully appreciate it, not just have some relic in the corner of their room to show off and go, hey, look what I got. This is cool.
Yeah, some guy in the Arctic carved this. Yeah, absolutely. The ethical side of setting initiation demands from me a really strong core of ethics in my dealings with other magicians, with the materials that I work with. I used to carve marine ivories a lot and walrus tusks and stuff like that. Because of where I live, you know, and I'm getting them from hunters, and I thought that, you know, okay, this is okay. These guys are eating these animals. Well, through my work in the Arctae element, I developed a very strong sense of a magical connection to life and to its integrity. And I realized that, well, I'm not Inuit, and I don't hunt these animals, and I have no right to carve them. And so I stopped, which was, it was a major part of my business at the time, and I just dropped it right as soon as I understood that aspect of what I was doing. It ended. I could not carve, to this day, I can't carve marine ivories anymore. I just won't do it. So those ethics are extremely well embedded in my work. And that goes, again, and having people buy artwork like that, having people from the South buy marine ivories, they have no idea what they're doing or what they're getting. And no respect for that. They just, because I have money, I can buy it. Well, yeah, you can do that with a lot of things, and you can watch your world go away too, because that's exactly what'll happen.
Yeah, I can understand that. Now, I have this one question I wanted to ask this earlier when we were talking about metal. I've seen pictures of in and around your place up in the Yukon, and in one picture that a friend of ours showed me, it showed a road with like 20 feet of snow on either side. So when you're working on melting the metal, is it more difficult because you're in such a cold area? I mean, do you have to really crank up your forge or something?
Nope. I have a torch that will do 3,000 degrees and it'll melt anything.
Now, does that make the room that you work in extra hot, like you don't need to turn your heater on when you're working with metal?
I have an extremely large space, probably about 2,500 square feet in the room where I do all my metal work, and a huge wood stove. And if it's cold out, yeah, it gets chilly inside the shop, but not, no, it's not bad. The weather up here doesn't, weather doesn't affect art. I just use the weather.
Well, that's good.
If I need to go ice carving, well, I go ice carving. Yeah, I did the Canada snow sculpture competition a few years back, and we came in third because I pissed off one of the judges.
Did you do it with a chainsaw?
Yep, chainsaws and great big shovel chisels, and we made chisels out of shovels and, you know, 12 foot by 12 foot by 16 foot block of snow, and you go at it, and you have 30 hours to do it.
Wow.
And that was a lot of work, yeah. And but it's very enjoyable to work with artists from all over the world and do these massive creations in front of in our nation's capital. And yeah, that was it was a fun trip. Not something I recommend for artists unless they're feeling really, really strong.
Yeah.
But now, yeah.
Now we've been talking about all this different art that you do. Do you actually like have a website where people can see some of your artwork and possibly contact you if they wanted to contract you?
I have one being made right now, and it's wolvesworks.ca, and that's wulvesz.werx.ca, and that should be up within the next month or so. And I'm hoping to introduce my jewelry there. The stone carving is something I'm going to keep special to myself and to my Setian initiation. And I want to create some larger sculptures of like all the images of Set were chiseled out of walls, and there's very few in existence compared to the other netters that are out there. And I would like to see a lot more Setian images done before my time's up here. And I can do that, or at least I can inspire that in other beings and teach. I teach stone carving now as opposed to doing a lot of it. And I want to put more effort into the things that people can afford. Stone sculptures are very expensive and hard for people to afford, but I'd like to see more of those done. There was actually a piece, and our high priestess provided a lot of information on this for me, found in Dakhla Oasis in 2002, which for some reason I was looking for images of Set on the internet, and I found this little tiny, the guy that cast it for me called it a little doggy. and it's this little image of Set that the Setian priests used to wear, and it's so it's an amulet. And so I traced it off my computer screen and carved a wax of it and sent it to at this time I wasn't doing metalwork, and sent it to a guy to have it cast, and he sent it back. I had 9 of them made, and I gave one to each of the people in the Order of Setnikamoast and the High Priestess, and she was just tickled because she had just seen this piece come out, and it was a very similar image. It's not identical because I don't like copying stuff, but to remanifest something that is 5,000 years old is just a thrill and a half. I mean, yeah,
I can see that. Now, to just sort of finish up a little bit here for anyone, I mean, within the temple or without, who is looking to use art through initiation, can you think of why that would be valuable for them to do?
Yeah, art pushes you to... Artists are generally really deep thinkers, and if they're going to do a piece, it's going to push you in directions that you aren't aware of until you start doing that piece. Whatever your concept of the piece is when you start, it will change. It will grow, it'll expand, and especially if you're SETI and you have access to so much information, really good information, that will ultimately be incorporated through your initiation into your artwork. And that's a process that just happens. You won't get around that. It'll come out of you. And I encourage artists to research their projects and get the most out of, actually feel what it's like to create a living thing, because that's essentially what you're doing. If you're applying initiation to art, you're creating something that's living. It's going to go beyond you. It has a life of its own, and you want to take that into a world that it's never been before. So you are changing the future in that aspect, and by the integrity that you bring to your artwork, that will be what goes into the future.
Well, James, I have to say thank you for giving us this interview. I am definitely going to put a link up to your site and let everyone know that it will be available shortly, so people can see more of your work. And I believe I have a picture of the Stella of Set, and I'm going to put that up as the main photograph so everyone can see this, because this is quite an extraordinary piece. You've been listening to KHPR, The Voice of Darkness. If you have any questions or comments, you can email them to us at khpr@keffer.org. Thank you for listening. And we hope that we've been able to bring about some change for you.
I'm fucking Ozzy Osbourne, the Prince of fucking Darkness. Evil, evil, but fucking evil.
There can be only one Prince of Darkness.
And that would be me, Robert Adams.